On Tuesday, November 18th, Russia launched yet another massive missile strike in Ukraine, targeting the country's energy infrastructure and triggering emergency power cuts across the country. As Ukraine braces itself for winter, Ukrainian NGOs and the international community are working hard to stem the growing health crisis in the country. I'm Lauren Racy, and in today's episode of New Security Broadcast, I have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Maria Dolinska, Medical Director for the Ukrainian NGO Infection Control in Ukraine, and Ambassador Daniel Speckhart, President and CEO of Chorus International, an ensemble of development organizations that includes Lutheran World Relief and IMA World Health. The interview was recorded on November 18th, and we were lucky that Dr. Dolinska, who's based in Kyiv, was able to join us. Ambassador Speckhart was just back from a 10-day trip across the country to launch Chorus-supported mobile health clinics, working with Ukrainian experts like Dr. Dolinska. Despite the immense hurdles facing healthcare provision in Ukraine, the conversation with Dr. Dolinska and Ambassador Speckhart shows how partnerships between international and local organizations can enable more effective and innovative provision of health services in the midst of extreme hardship. So Ambassador Speckhart and Dr. Dolinska, thank you so much for joining us today, and Dr. Maria, especially for joining us from Kyiv. I know in the middle of a very hard situation where you are probably on a nonstop schedule. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Ambassador Speckhart, could you know, you've had a fascinating career in and out of the region and are sort of in this lead role at Chorus International. Can you share with us what your work at Chorus International is and how you ended up there?
Sure, be happy to do that. But first, just also want to thank Dr. Maria, who's our partner in Ukraine. You may not know this, but your listeners as well should know. I mean, today was another very bad day for rocket attacks. And so she is coming to us from a place that's still literally in the middle of a war. So thank you, Dr. Maria. For me, the journey to get to this point where I can be talking to you about Ukraine is a very interesting one in the context of all the different things I've been able to do, right? I was a diplomat and I was ambassador to Belarus, which neighbors to the north of Ukraine. I was a NATO official, the Deputy Assistant Secretary General for Political Affairs and responsible for NATO-Russia relations and NATO-Ukraine relations and bringing new members into NATO. And I then was also deputy to the ambassador as the deputy chief of mission in Iraq, where I also oversaw the reconstruction of Iraq. So lots of different things, both in the context of peace and war, very heavily internationally focused and on the diplomacy. But I, after 30 years, I decided I wanted to have a different impact the world in a different way and moved to the nonprofit sector and became a leader of an NGO. It's now called Chorus International, but it really is because of we've done a couple of mergers and acquisitions. I felt very strongly, and it fits with the resilience message of this program, that you have to have a more holistic approach to the way we do development, right? That we're very stovepipe, we pick specialized areas and we function well in those areas. But if you're looking at the challenges from the families that we serve, their problems are multiple, right? It's not just poverty in the context of livelihoods, it's also health, it's also environment, it's also employment. And so we've created a group at Chorus that includes impact investing, health, environment, livelihoods, and actually direct trade into US markets to try to get more back to people serving it. Spent a lot of my career on Ukraine off and on, so know the country well, have a deep spot in my heart for the country and its people.
Thank you. Dr. Maria, you, I do know that this is just a really tough time and appreciate you being available for this conversation today. And as I understand it, before Russia's incursion into Ukraine, your work was focused on implementing infection prevention and control programs in the country. But since the war has started, obviously your focus has switched to providing more of that emergency humanitarian response. Can you tell us about the work that you are doing today and what some of the the high priority health needs that you see on the ground are?
Thank you for the invitation, and we are extremely grateful to Chorus International for an opportunity to do what I believe every Ukrainian have to do, because everybody of us have to do everything that we can. And thanks to Chorus International, we can do much, much for our people who are staying under constant attacks, who are suffering from infrastructure disruptions and actually the chronic stress, the chronic health problem. Because, you know, we have almost more than 8 months of war so far. And during the quite long time, lots of health condition can progress. And now we already see lots of neglected disease because people are not up to their health, obviously. And actually, we see one of our most important missions under these circumstances. It is somewhat new for our organization as an organization working in some particular health issue, but we understand it as a possibility to improve primary care in general, because infection prevention and control is mainly focused on primary care. And now we expanded our area to clinical services, to support clinical services of primary care by experts or with some sophisticated equipment. And as Dr. Spector has it, it is somewhat challenging because of power supply. But anyway, so far we managed to do it because actually it looks so that we are well prepared to this. We're trying to reach the most remote areas when people have limited access to large clinical centers to provide them screening for most common health condition, infectious and non-infectious, and also importantly, providing them psychological support, which is quite new and quite uncommon for Ukraine. It is not covered for state health programs, and we're doing psychological support and even provide some psychotherapy for those who need it. I think that this opportunity, which was given us by Chorus International, is some pilot initiative in Ukraine. It is not so common.
So what? So this is sort of a new approach to healthcare in the country, obviously, given the circumstances. But also, it sounds like Chorus International has provided the means to evolve how healthcare is being provided in communities. Can you walk us through, I don't know if this is a fair question, but if you could walk us through what a typical, doesn't sound like the right word, but I'm going to say it anyways, a typical day might look like for you and your team. Is it setting up a mobile clinic and driving to a community? What does it look like and who's on that team and how do you connect with the communities?
We have several mobile teams of experts with the most demanded specialties like cardiologists, gynecologists, etc. And we also have a mobile clinic which is moving to the most remote areas where building of healthcare centers have not enough capacities or sometimes they're even disrupted. So some mobile teams can use existing building and some of them cannot. That's why it is a mixed mood. Mobile clinics and one mobile clinic and several mobile teams. And these mobile teams also include psychologists and psychotherapists who do screening of post-traumatic stress reaction and propose and provide a long-term therapy for those who require it. So, and in terms of this, we combine in-person and online care. Actually, now it is somewhat challenging because internet connection is not as reliable as before the war, but if it's possible, we are doing our best to establish it.
Thank you. Ambassador, you're just back from a trip to Ukraine. Can you tell us about your travels and where you went and sort of what stood out to you? What did you find surprising and sort of what maybe met your expectations on that trip?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking that. I just did have a chance to travel throughout the country, starting in the western part of the country, places like Morshin and Lviv, and then a little bit to the north in Rivne, and spent time in Kiev, and then went to Kharkiv, which is about 40 or 50 kilometers from the front, and was really a city that took huge amounts of damage from the Russians. Although similarly, you can go just equal 40 or 50 miles north from Kiev and see that same kind of damage in Bucha and Irpin, places like that. What sticks out at you is the magnitude of the immense suffering that's happening right now in the country. From literally 15 million people have been displaced, about 7 million have moved outside the country, but there's still 7 million people that are trying to find other places in that country and are not at home, right? And then most of those had to leave without really anything but what they could carry. UN says about 15 million of those are in need of humanitarian assistance. 1 in 3 are food insecure. And I guess what surprised me a lot, again, was remembering the demographics of this country, right? That looks a lot different than other countries I worked in, which is it's not a population with a lot of young people. It really is a populace that's aging. So what you see is a lot of these people that are in difficult circumstances and suffering are elderly and disabled people, right? And we're talking 60s, 70s, 80s. I met even with one 96-year-old woman in one of the shelters in the Kharkiv area where I visited with Dr. Maria. And many of these people, they don't have families. Otherwise, they would have gone to their families, right? And they have just gone through 4, 5, 6 months of horrific conditions where they were living in their basements. And so that's also why Dr. Maria talks about what happens to their health situation after they've been in that particular. And the pharmaceutical processes, the ability to get your medicines, it's all been disrupted and broken by the war, creating challenges. Last thing I'd mention is the psychological trauma. She mentioned that they have therapists working on this, but you just forget until you see it close up. And I got to talk to many of these displaced people, and the mothers were telling me how their children would still startle whenever a ball bounced, right? Just any noise, how even months later that they just are not feeling safe. And the sad thing, of course, is many of these people moved west. So in a place like Morshin or Rivne to be safe away from the war, but now the rockets are attacking cities all around that. And you can hear sometimes those rockets going on. Of course, it's re-traumatizing the children and the mothers. And I should also say these families are oftentimes separated because there aren't men in these groups, right? The men have stayed back to fight the war. So you're basically seeing mothers and children or the elderly.
Are the children able to go to school in those communities?
Yes, they are. And I got a chance to see how that works. But I have to be honest with you, it's suboptimal. I know for anybody here listening who's gone through COVID and saw what it was like to try to do school virtually, that's really where most of these displaced populations are trying to get their education. But you're reliant on electricity, first and foremost. Second, the computers they have are not up to standard, right? People have come to the service. Ukrainians are sticking together and they're finding all their old computers. But we're talking about, you know, computers that look to me like from the 1990s or early 2000s, right? So you have the challenges of getting those computers to work. You have the challenges of these school classrooms that have been broken apart, right? So what they're trying to do is the teacher that was teaching you in Kharkiv is still trying to teach their class, and some kids are in Morshin, and some kids are in Rivne, some kids are actually in Poland, and they're trying to log on a couple times a day, but you're trying to make that all work, the internet connections, the electricity, and everything else. It's Herculean. The kids are glad they can still be connected, but I have to be honest with you, the generation here is going to really fall behind on the education as this system is not up to the ability to meet the needs of those 15 million displaced people.
I mean, that brings me to a question about sort of the over the horizon issues, right? There's such an immediate need, but then you also see sort of how some of these sort of incremental and compounding challenges are going to sort of reshape the future of the country and the challenges that they have to meet in the next generation and following generations. I think one of the things that we see are study reports of damage done to infrastructure in Ukraine. So thinking about hospital and healthcare centers, but also dams, ports, and other critical infrastructure. One of the focuses of our program at the Wilson Center is looking at the connections between environmental issues and conflict, right? And so you see the resulting environmental damage from this destruction that, you know, pollutes the drinking water and releases toxins into the air and groundwater. And I think we're already seeing reports of this coming out today with impacts on communities not having access to clean drinking water, but it also speaks to the longer term recovery needs for the country. Dr. Maria, what are some of the long-term issues that you see coming? And, you know, in addition to sort of the mental health, if you want to expand on that, but what are the other issues that the healthcare community is is thinking about in order to prepare for, you know, curbing the worst of the war's impacts and building that long-term resilience.
Yes, actually, we are just starting to recognize the long-term issues we have to deal with during the next year or next decades after the war is ended. As far as I'm able to sketch up these issues, the main of them are related to the environmental impact. Power quality of water, quality of sewage, quality of waste management was in focus of our activity before the war, and we pretty well understand that it was not ideal even in peacetime. And now, after the massive attacks and massive infrastructure damage, it becomes more and more complicated. So we see interruption in water supply. We see that water quality and drinking water is not under proper control. We see that waste segregation, I mean household and medical waste segregation, is also a challenge. And another group of issues is related to chronic conditions, because as I mentioned, some of them are neglected, and we expect some of them are underdiagnosed, like tuberculosis, for instance. Before the war, I was dealing with tuberculosis, and I clearly understand the potential impact of underdetected cases. So they will exploit with an outbreak of the severe and unfavorable cases. The same can happen with malignancies, with coronary heart disease, or with the majority of chronic health conditions. So we expect it, and we try to prevent as many neglected cases as we can.
Pastor Speckhard, do you want to comment on that as well?
Dr. Maria really understands the health kind of pieces of this, but I can add on the environmental piece, the closing of Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is also a big issue in the context. Let's hope that there is no nuclear challenges to the environment as a result of that. But even so, what happens is, as Ukraine struggles to meet its energy needs, right, it's going to look to less clean mechanisms for that. Kiev already has a fair amount of air pollution on some days. And in the local places and local communities, you're going to see everybody moving to wood and coal burning stoves in the rural areas and in the towns and even in the cities, I would expect. And you're going to see power plants having to use coal and other things. So you're going to see a big impact as well from the closing of nuclear power plant. If I could switch, though, on this point on over the horizon, I think there is also some other strategic issues related to this in terms of how we think of the issues that are coming down the road. One thing I tried to do when I was in Ukraine was encourage Ukrainians to understand the long game here. And inoculate themselves, if I can use a medical term, but on the political side, to what is really going to be happening, the insidious effects of these attacks on the infrastructure and targeting civilians means that over time, there is going to be erosion of political unity. Right now, everybody's all in. The war is raging in the east. They know they need to be together. They're watching, the liberation of Kherson. It gives them some upbeat sense. But what happens if we move into a place, let's hope, where some of the fighting lulls or stops or moves into some sort of peace situation? That infrastructure isn't going to be rebuilt overnight. And what you're going to see is people are going to start blaming not the Russians at some point in time, but their own government for not fixing it. It takes a while to happen, but it does happen in all the countries that I've worked in the past. And so what I'm worried about is when that comes down the road is that they start blaming Kiev, not Moscow, for the fact that they have no clean water, they have no electricity, they have no heat. And it's going to take a long time for this country to rebuild. So I want to remind Ukrainians to be patient, to understand the long road ahead of them, but that this isn't Kiev's fault, right? This is the fault of the people that sent rockets into this infrastructure, and understand that to give them some political resilience, since you're talking about resilience as this goes forward. Second team, we got to remind Over the Horizon the need for long-term commitments on the economic front, right? Thanks for helping EU for seeing FY23 and $18 billion in loans, but these are loans, right? Which isn't going to help in the long term. US is going to give more support really needed, but this is a multi-year challenge for this country. If we don't see it as a multi-year challenge, what will happen is you'll win the battle and you'll lose the war, right? Because the country will fracture and go back into a bad place when it can't recover. Third, you need to create hope in that Over the Horizon stuff, right? Supporting Ukrainian aspirations for a European future, right? That's how that we got into this situation, right? You can go back to the Maidan Revolution. It was because Russia was manipulating the political system in a way that denied their ability to pursue an EU future, right? And then that played itself out, and Russia has not been able to stop that European aspiration. And so here we are again in war. You can't close that door to the Ukrainians, even if the conflict gets stuck somehow in the eastern part of the country. Let them know that future is there, because it's going to be a tough decade ahead, given what's happened to their infrastructure. So I just wanted, that's some of the resilience things that are part of, I think, looking forward to ensuring that they have the wherewithal to last through what's going to be a difficult period.
As a former diplomat and somebody who's leading a large international, you know, development, international development agency, or not agency, sorry, but consortium.
Yeah.
Do you see an opportunity for governments and NGOs to work together in new ways to support a country like Ukraine in crisis? Do you see sort of this leveraging of innovation, of new approaches to whether it's, you know, health or education or
yes,
right? Like, but that sort of that evolving relationship that's not just state-led, but leveraging the expertise of NGOs like Horus International.
I do. I think Ukraine is going to be a, you know, the positive piece on this is that when these challenges happen, there are times for innovation, right? Countries that go through these difficult periods often come up with solutions that you wouldn't have gotten if things were in peacetime. And so I see that happening. And particularly Ukraine is a perfect country to help innovate because they have such a highly educated workforce. They are so advanced on the technology front, right? And how they're going to use technology and the stresses on their infrastructure system and find ways to continue to provide services. We, for instance, are working with the Ministry of Social Policy because one group in our consortium is a technology company called CGA Technologies, and they're advising the Ministry of Social Policy on how to organize the international community to ensure that they're all plugging into the same platform, which is the government's platform, not our parallel structures and systems, to track vulnerable populations, to know who is getting supported, to what the support that they're getting is, to make sure there's not duplication, that people aren't being lost, and the most vulnerable are being prioritized, right? So these kind of things, perfect country to do in Ukraine, that I know we're going to be able to take to other countries in the world to be able to do that. The healthcare work that Maria is doing, you know, you're using really sophisticated stuff, right? Cardiologists, all this kind of advanced services in the humanitarian space is really powerful stuff because, you know, I have to be honest with you, in many of the countries where this happens, cardiologists aren't there. They just don't exist. They aren't in great outside the capital, right? So we're going to figure out how to take very advanced services, needed services for all the populations. And then won't it be fun if we can figure out how to use that in developing spaces that didn't have those? And in fact, it might be able to use those in ways that wasn't a war or a crisis. It was just the lack of infrastructure to begin with, in rural or remote areas around other countries that are much less developed than that. So I'm very hopeful and positive that some of the things that's happening with Dr. Dolinska's team and the stuff we're doing to support them is going to be used elsewhere.
Fantastic. Dr. Maria, you know, Ukraine is still getting a lot of headlines here in the US, and rightly so, but my assumption is that there are a lot of stories that aren't being told. And I wonder if, from your perspective, if there are any sort of key issues or priority areas or opportunities for, you know, a stronger response that you would like the international community to be more aware of.
Actually, the main area and the main direction we're working is, we believe these are just the most urgent one in Ukraine. And as Ambassador Speckhardt said, the mental health is one of the most important issues, because it looks like every Ukrainian surviving this war will have some more or less severe psychological trauma, and we have to deal with it. And this part of care, unlike medical care, is not so advanced in Ukraine. So it is maybe one of the most important areas. And another area is infrastructure. You can do nothing with even advanced specialists and advanced equipment if you have no necessary basic water supply, electricity, and heating. And actually, this is the issue is needed for some solution, because what we see, for instance, in Kyiv, in the capital, so after some severe attack, which was happened at the end of October, it looks like the local electricity supply started to recover. And just today, just a couple of hours ago, we learned that there are lots of severe infrastructure impacts, and we are not even informed on the scale, so we do not understand it yet. But as we are informed, the sequela will be more severe than before. And yes, of course, this complicate our planning. So sometimes we do not know what can we do it, what have we to do tomorrow. It's actually infrastructure. Anyway, health is important, but infrastructure is the key for everything. And we are really grateful, once again, we are really grateful to Chorus International, to the opportunity to improve health and some kind of infrastructure, at least wash the basic health infrastructure simultaneously. I think that it is a very successful combination, and we would like to expand it.
Sorry, what kind of combination?
I mean clinical services and medical infrastructure improvement in terms of water, sanitation, and hygiene.
Yeah, okay. Oh, that's fantastic. I saw that the World Health Organization just signed a memorandum on cooperation to strengthen mental health service access in Ukraine with the government. I wonder about the mental health of people like you, Dr. Maria, who are really working on this day after day, and sort of the exposure you have to some of the hardest hit parts of the country and the people who are living there. I don't want to ask you too personal of a question, but is that part of your focus on mental health, is making sure that the service providers are also being cared for?
And thank you for your question. It's really important, and I'm okay to answer any personal question. And we are lucky to have a great psychologist and psychotherapist in our team, Mrs. Olga Yevlanova, who is certified psychologist and a cognitive behavioral therapist with about 15 years of experience. And she started, she stipulated that the basics of our activities to taking care about our own mental health. So she introduced testing on burning out and trauma reactions for each team member. We're doing it on a monthly basis. And she, at least she proposed to her help to every team member. I mean, the team or member of our NGO and all clinicians and all social workers and all psychologists who are involved as well. Because yes, of course, it's important. And I'm afraid that nobody can avoid some kind of burning out. So we are trying to minimize it, but I'm afraid it is inevitable.
Lauren, these emergency service and health workers are just really heroic. That's one thing I got to see close up. Met in Kharkiv with the emergency services there, the ones, the firefighters and the ambulance drivers and others. And these people were putting out fires in these high rises while still under fire, right? The carnage that they saw, the just horrific images that they had to be a part of and see while they're trying to save lives, is something that is going to impact them for a very long time. And so it is ensuring that they, and I'm also particularly worried after this Hopefully peace comes back to Ukraine, right? Right now, they're still all in, right? And they're just working on adrenaline, even 6 or 7 or 8 months into it. But you can see that the ability to sustain that is really difficult, and what they have seen, you know. Our team was just in Kupiansk not too long ago, one of the liberated, a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, met one of these little five-year-old girls who was pulled from out under her parents' dead bodies, right? And, you know, it's the child is horrifically traumatized, but then the worker who is holding this little kid without a coat, without a home, with nothing, right? And that sticks in your mind. It sticks in my mind. And I wasn't even there when it happened. And it's still something I remember from visiting. That's been repeated literally hundreds of thousands of times. And so the mental health issues are significant. And I think I'll probably go on a limb here because I'm not a doctor, but I think there's a direct connection between mental health and physical health, right? And so you're going to see that play out in physical health of the country as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That stress on the body systems. I should stop myself too. I'm also not a doctor, but Dr. Marie should probably comment on it.
We're human and we know it.
Yes, absolutely. So putting on your diplomat hat again for a minute, Ambassador Speckhard, what do you think the international community is missing in the response in Ukraine?
Well, I think there's a couple of things here. First, it's not the same as many less developed countries, right? So I think the international community is used to responding to many of these kind of situations, but in much more fragile country context, as opposed to a country that's fairly well developed like Ukraine. So that means there's significant institutional capacity here and the importance of ensuring you understand that, those of us who are coming to support Ukraine, the need to continue to work hard to tap into organizations like federal trade unions that we're working closely with, emergency services, ministries, and to not UNize this, if I can use that word, and create a parallel structure, because we want to ensure accountability, yes, but if we create those parallel structures, we're actually going to be duplicative and not building in, strengthening the resilience and capacity of the existing structures and relying on what's already there. So that's one thing, you know, making sure we understand this country well enough and don't just bring in rubber stamped systems or duplicatives. Let me try to figure out how to say that better. So we don't bring into the country what we thought worked somewhere else, but didn't recognize what this country already has. Second, I think we need to understand that savings are being tremendously exhausted, right? Country, we talked about the displaced 15 million people, but the rest of the country is also suffering from the economic collapse. Unemployment is at 35%, and that might be underestimating it. Inflation on basic goods, foodstuffs at 24%. And the humanitarian situation is likely to worsen. Most of these people have been using all the savings they had, right, to get them to where they are, relying on the savings of other family members. At some point in time, that starts to get exhausted. And I think as you see us go through the winter here, you're going to start to see and to make sure we understand that it's not just the displaced people that are going to need support as we look at that. Third, that there's a broader knock-on effect happening and occurring in food security in many other countries, and that the international community can't just focus on Ukraine, but needs to understand a humanitarian crisis is being extended beyond the borders of Ukraine. And then last, it's really hard to do this humanitarian work and health work while the war is going on, right there. And I know that we all want to find a way to end the war, but understanding it's really, really difficult what Dr. Maria is doing when the rockets are still coming in, the mortar fire and the attacks.
Dr. Maria, are there aspects of the situation in Ukraine? Are there sort of specific issues or ways that you think the international community can be more responsive in the months ahead, especially thinking about as we head towards winter, right? And the sort of energy situation in the country and making sure that people have access to, you know, heat and food. What do you hope that the international community is really investing in the months ahead for the country?
Thank you. Yes, of course, we're expecting a difficult winter, but anyway, I hope we will survive it. I'm not talking about physically surviving, but survive as a health system, as an infrastructure system. But we really need the restoration of the, first of all, of electricity supply. And now, as I observe, many health facilities, many health systems are trying to switch on some autonomic power supply. We are not actually, we're not ideally prepared for that, but the situation is improving. So some kind of generators are coming, and it is one of the most important point of support. So now it is maybe the most required things, even it is even more needed than water supply, etc. So we're starting from electricity, because currently all health services and all life supporting services, as food services as well, are based on electricity supply. So it is vital for us so far. And next is some kind of specialized care. So as I mentioned, now we're working on primary care. It is due to enormous need in the basic care for lots of people. But given that the war is long lasting now, and some critical condition may need specialized care, we need some referral mechanism. So we know that many patients with some difficult conditions are transferred abroad for treatment, and I hope that this situation will expand, because it's really needed. More and more people have not received the appropriate care for their special conditions under unreliable power supply, unreliable internet connection, because medical care currently is based on internet connection as well. So it is not 19th century when some one hero doctor can save people's lives, unfortunately. It is impossible today.
Yeah, of course. Ambassador Speckhard, going back to a point that you made about the sort of rippling effects of the crisis in Ukraine, right? We see it in East Africa and sort of the food security of the many countries that rely on the region, right? Ukraine and Russia being sort of a breadbasket for the region, but also in terms of the limited supply of potash or potash. I don't actually know how. I think I've heard both potash for fertilizer, right? And then of course the energy security impacts outside of the country. So for Course International, how do you keep your eye on the ball in Ukraine while also continuing to support the other countries and regions in crisis around the world? What does that balance look like?
Yeah, well, when you're an organization like ours, you can't do everything. We are trying to make sure all those people who support us understand this connection, right? That food connection, particularly for the really countries that are suffering from malnutrition and hunger. Ukraine by itself has pushed another 71 million people, you know, the situation in Ukraine, not Ukraine, into crises. Of poverty by the cost of living increases in many of these countries. People can't afford the foodstuffs that they used to be able to afford, and they're having struggling feeding their family. There's about 50 million people in the world now facing emergency levels of starvation, and about 350 million at acute levels of food insecurity. So this is a big deal, right? There's a lot of people really suffering. And after the issue of the environmental shocks and then COVID and the supply chain shocks, adding the Ukraine shock on top of that has just been too much for many of these places. So what we're doing is we're trying to make sure the people who support us understand this, and we've actually set up a special program. We've chosen one country that we can do more in. We can't do it everywhere, but we pick Mali. It's not just East Africa, but West Africa has also been hard hurt by this, and we're having a specific focus on food security in these places and the hunger issues for the most vulnerable communities. That's what needs to happen internationally. You know, the G20 is meeting right now. They're spending a lot of time talking about Ukraine and the war itself, but they need to spend more time talking about what's happening in countries like this. And we need to get more attention on that. So while we have to be able to do both, we have to be able to help Ukraine, but we can't let 50 million people die of starvation in the rest of the world because they can't feed their children, or wasting due to malnutrition that comes from that. So a lot needs to be done there, not just our organization, but a lot of others are focused on that. I would encourage your audience and listeners to educate themselves and spread the news in their own social media and challenges, because people do care. When I talk to people, they care, they want to do something, want to support it, but it gets lost in the news cycle of so many other crises around the world.
Well, I also feel like it becomes overwhelming, right? And it's hard to know what kind of impact an individual can have, right? But that sort of starting with educating yourself on the issues, and then maybe finding sort of that thread that is most important to you, or really speaks to you, and just focusing it there, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of like taking Chorus International on a very small scale in terms of figuring out where you can have an impact.
That's beautifully said, Lauren. And the reality is, I sometimes worry about talking about 50 million people because it overwhelms people and then people just can't hear it, right? All it takes is for you, your listener, to support one person, right? And there's enough people out there listening, there's enough people out there caring, that 50 million isn't so much when you're in a planet of 7 billion people, right? And what I encourage you to do is find that organization that you know, you trust is doing that kind of work, and reach out and just remember, right? And even, you know, I'm sorry, this is a plug, but for those that can do something on a monthly basis, that's what makes a difference to all organizations like ours, right? It's wonderful that everybody gives me, they see a Ukraine story and then they give me some money, and then we're supposed to make that last for 3 or 4 years, right? That's the hard part. So I really need, we and all these other organizations need the kind of people that are saying, I'm in this for the long term. I care about these issues, the issues that your podcast is talking about, right? And I want to have an impact over the longer term. It does make a difference, you know, even small amounts make a huge difference in these places. The only other thing I would mention is people look for the organizations, look for the ones, and you're a show about resilience, that really focus on the issues of capacity building and local involvement and inclusion, right? The ones that really engage locally at the grassroots level, like you're seeing here that we're doing with Dr. Maria, making sure the local voices are involved. And then also making sure that what's happening there, we talked about today, is innovation, ideas that are coming in through the cooperation and collaboration. And over time, what happens is you get sustainability, right? That whatever somebody gave, that $100 check, $50 or $20 check, it actually allowed some, it multiplied many times over, if that makes sense. So for me, this issue of resilience and doing it through capacity building, collaboration, and local involvement and voices and inclusion is key.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Dr. Maria is a perfect example of the importance of working with people who have the expertise and knowledge on the ground. And it doesn't have to be like, you know, specific medical expertise. I think one of the things that we've found is how important it is to be sort of engaging at the community level all the way up to the international level, so that not only do you understand how communities on the ground perceive their own risks, right, which is important for interventions, but also the capacity that they already have and the resilience that they have already have, so that you can be investing in that. And I think Ukraine has been an exemplary, an example to all of us of the resilience and the strength of a really incredible country. So Dr. Maria, thank you so much for being with us today and for sharing your expertise and your experience and your knowledge in the midst of what I know is a tough day and a tough week and a tough year, but really appreciate you taking the time. And Ambassador Speckhart, thank you so much. Thank you for the work that you're doing at Chorus International and for taking the time to talk to us today and share with us, you know, the experience from your trip to Ukraine. And just, I think that the perspective that you have as a former diplomat who is leading a development NGO, I think is a really important one that is helpful for our audience in terms of framing how these risks are connected, but, you know, politically, sort of human health, but also in terms of that long-term resilience of the country, and making those connections is really key. So thank you both very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Lauren. Great to see you again, Dr. Maria. Really appreciate the opportunity to have the conversation.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ambassador Becker. Thank you.
You've been listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.